Well, thank you, everyone. I appreciate everyone choosing this healthcare reform session over the other healthcare reform session that they somehow managed to schedule at the same time slot. I guess nobody wanted to wait. Everyone wanted to get right out of the gate on this. What I'm going to do may be a little different, too, and I will, so it may seem a little bit jumpy, but I think for people who have been, who are in public health, who are watching the healthcare reform debate, you realize we've kind of often played with a lot of the terminology. Sometimes people talk about health reform when they really want to sort of emphasize health, but more often we've kind of gone the other way and we've shifted the terms from healthcare reform to health insurance reform, which I think is a really telling aspect in that while we do know and appreciate the role of insurance in helping people's health, that it's often very difficult to really talk about how we really expect healthcare reform to benefit people's health beyond coverage. So at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, the Commissioner John Auerbach took it upon himself within the healthcare debate in Massachusetts to really say, how can we inform the debate on healthcare reform with an aspect of what we think some of the impacts really are on health? And so I'll be talking about some of the particular program work we're doing that relates to how public health can link to and inform healthcare reform. But some of those connections, I'll do my best to make them clear, but feel free to ask questions. So first, a little bit of background on the Massachusetts healthcare reform. And when I did a presentation somewhat similar to this at a CDC conference on chronic disease integration, which is again the genesis of this presentation, a lot of this was new to people, and now I think 6 months later it's a lot more familiar as people have kind of seen sort of day after day, you know, week after week, some of the discussion of what's going to be in healthcare reform bills. So the key in Massachusetts, again, was everybody coming to the table and everybody giving a little and getting something, hopefully, you know, in the long run, getting more than they've had to give. Consumers were seeing a Medicaid expansion. Again, that's similar to what's now being proposed at the federal level. Additional subsidies and some more responsibility on the part of their employers to offer health insurance. Providers were primarily seeing Medicare rate increases, Medicaid rate increases. Businesses got a sort of lower assessment than what might have been for as penalties for not offering health care insurance, and some expanded subsidies for small employers and their low-wage workers. I'll have more to say about that. Insurers, again, had new potential members based on the mandate, some young adult products that were very cost-effective, as well as the individual mandate, which resulted in these things. Again, from who gave what were some of the costs to people? Again, consumers had to face the individual mandate, and we're hearing a lot about this right now as we get to crunch time on healthcare reform, and some of the surveys have showed you know, people who were essentially forced to buy insurance or pay a cost through their taxes were among the people least satisfied with healthcare reform. Providers received more pay-for-performance mechanisms so that some of the funding, the way the funding was structured was a direction that they were heading, but still less than they wanted. And businesses had more assessment than they wanted. Most of them wanted nothing. And the governor at the time, Mitt Romney, hard to believe he was governor of Massachusetts, but he was the vetoed, actually, the legislation because of the employer mandate, and it had to be overridden by the heavily Democratic legislature. They have more than veto-proof majorities in both houses in Massachusetts. And insurers had a lot of subsidized plans to limit current Medicaid managed care organizations for the first 3 years, and less flexibility on benefit design. I'm not going to go into, as I say, all the details, but a lot of minimal creditable coverage within Massachusetts, which I think is a very important piece, basically saying the minimum level of insurance coverage that has to be provided. And as you know, if people are informed about the debate, one of the big problems right now is the extent of copay, the caps on lifetime usage for certain illnesses, the size of deductibles, the exclusion of many medical conditions. And so those were all really eliminated or severely limited in Massachusetts, which I think is very important for making sure that the coverage that's provided is really real coverage. So I'm sorry for this, a little old. I couldn't get the updated slide, but it shows that basically from June 2006, when the coverage, the law went into effect, to June 2008, we had an increase of 442,000 covered lives. That number is closer to 600,000 lives. And most importantly now, the overall rate of the uninsured in Massachusetts has gone from about 10% to about 2.5%. And we think sort of like, you know, full employment is measured at 4%. We're going to come around in Massachusetts and maybe nationally to deciding what's a full insurance rate. You know, will you ever be able to get beyond 2.5%? Some of those are undocumented individuals who we may not be eligible for the subsidized programs. Some of those are just decliners, people who choose to pay the penalty instead of doing that. And some of that is sort of a transitional number, which is something we see, that people who are not used to having health insurance go on and off it periodically because they're not used to making payments, even if they're small. They really need a lot of support just utilizing health insurance. This is a slide that I love to show and talk about. And again, I'm sorry that the numbers are a little behind the times, but I can tell you that number is still hovering between 71 and 72%. This is the percent of employers offering health insurance. So coming around the table with everyone incentivized to continue to play a role, employers have not opted out of the health insurance, their role as providers of health insurance. And you know, that's a positive thing. There wasn't, and there continues to be, of course, discussion that the public option will cause this mass exodus of employees over to public options and essentially kill the existing structure of employer-supported health insurance. Some people may like that, but regardless, you don't need to do that to achieve high levels of insurance. And again, there's been emphasis in Massachusetts not just on coverage, but trying to do a lot of other activities to support reduction of costs. That has not particularly been successful, but I'll mention that when people talk about Massachusetts having one of the highest costs, if not the highest costs, of health insurance and medical care in the country, that is true. But that was actually true before we did health care reform. So there are other reasons for that, including the high concentration of teaching hospitals providing care for the citizens as compared to community hospitals and providers. And generally, you know, we're one of the, you know, top three cost of living places in the United States overall. So trying to improve quality improvement through transparency. There's efforts on reduction of hospital-acquired infections, which again has been a public health role. Establishing a chronic disease blueprint, which hasn't gone very well, but again is in the works, and I'll talk about, and this is a public health role. Disparities Council, specifically to focus on inequities in health. And again, not only was Medicaid charged with developing pay-for-performance, but there's been a payment reform commission that has really been looking at the notion of global payments and is really hopefully a cutting edge of radical change of the payment system, although we'll see if that gets very far. At the time, public health was charged with a major initiative on diabetes prevention and control and development of the chronic disease blueprint, and then outreach to the highest risk populations. I think one of the things to think about when thinking about the role of public health and healthcare reform is that over the past 30 years, many, particularly state health departments, have really evolved into programs for people lacking health insurance. And many of the programs have really been designed to fill that gap. And as the rates of those with insurance grow, a lot of these programs have to look at their functioning and say, well, what do we do if this was our job before? For our Women's Health Network program that's designed to provide cancer screening for breast and cervical cancer for women, we really did see the rates of women without insurance using that program plummet by greater than 50% in 2007 after the legislation was passed and in effect for 6 months. But on the plus side, that means that public health has linkages through a lot of programs to those most in need of health insurance. And so one of the things we did was mobilize all of our programs, like the Women's Health Network, like WIC, like our HIV and substance abuse outreach programs, to use, and our Community Health Center network, to use their enrollment folks to help people utilize the new health insurance law. We did education and training sessions. We made sure they had all the materials they needed. We asked their supervisors and their contractual programs to make sure that this became part of their contractual work plan so that it was something that they could do to support those efforts. We also spent some time looking for indications that healthcare reform has had an impact on health itself, searching all the possible databases for evidence that health status improves with reform. And that was difficult, but one of the things we did see was both rises in colorectal screening rates, which were substantial, and reductions in tobacco usage and cigarette smoking, which we at least attribute in part to more people having primary care providers and able to see a doctor and have tests performed and have linkages to tobacco cessation services. Again, and then I was just, the last line is mass in motion. I know I'm going to really have problems doing this, so I'm going to go quickly. High rates, increase of rates in diabetes, and all the things associated with the risks of diabetes. Again, we're doing, like many states, a rather comprehensive campaign on nutrition and physical activity. There is now, if you see in the lower right-hand corner, mass.gov/massinmotion, people who want to learn more about this particular campaign can see it there. But it was really geared towards low-income folks and through culturally diverse folks. And the governor who replaced Mitt Romney, Governor Deval Patrick, really took a lead on supporting this effort. And we did worksite wellness programs and grants to communities to help change local policies to support better eating and better physical activity. We've done regulations to support calorie posting that will go into effect in November of 2010 in fast food restaurants. You have to have 20 or more locations in Massachusetts. And to support BMI calculation and reporting in the schools. That may be delayed for a year because of the implementation of the H1N1 vaccine in schools. We're trying not to overwhelm the schools. And an executive order on purchasing of healthy foods throughout Massachusetts public sector entities. So again, some of the challenges with healthcare reform. The Globe and the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation of Massachusetts did a survey. That can be found on the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation website. There are still disparities. Here are charts showing the percentage of individuals reporting having a usual provider. And as you can see, Latino Hispanic populations was at 80% compared to over 90% for white and non-Hispanic, non-white populations. And this is taking a look at comparing people who had medical debt and did not have medical debt. So there's this, you know, existing burden out among the population of people really struggling with pre-existing medical debt based on the existing system. And so the people in yellow are those with who did not have who had medical debt. They were much more likely to not fill a prescription, to avoid medical treatment, and to use emergency departments. I'm going to skip that. This is just sort of the puzzle of many of the things that affect outcome beyond the availability of insurance per se, and things we're still struggling with. I'm just going to mention, because I have very little time left, that we were one of four states selected to do an integration of chronic disease programs. I've mentioned the Women's Health Network. This also pulls together our cardiovascular programs, tobacco programs, our obesity and overweight programs, and our comprehensive cancer programs, and our BRFSS work. We have an overall goal to improve health outcomes and eliminate disparities across the lifespan. And I'm just going to say, I'm sorry to go through this, I guess this is in the learning session to do, that the things we're really finding is we have to do integration internally first in order to be able to share that out in the community with the program. So we're really working to develop common language among these programs, to share a common vision, to think about sharing resources, building trust internally, and that we want to work within a social determinants context and work on primary prevention with an emphasis on policy, environment, and systems change. And then, again, some of the challenges we're finding are transitioning people from a more siloed point of view to a more integrated point of view. The sharing of resources is always challenging. And just conceptualizing what integration means is often very difficult for individuals. They can do it in the specific, but it's very difficult to do in a broader sense. And I will then stop there, and again, apologize for kind of rushing through some of the end, and happy to take some questions.
Yeah, I just had a very basic question about the program, the Chronic Disease Integration Program.
Sure.
Could you just give a brief, maybe, description of what that means in terms of integrating services?
So one way to talk about it, Janet Collins, who was heading this effort in the chronic disease division of CDC, used to use an architectural drawings. And one of the things she looked at was sort of a building that has a sort of low-lying horizontal unit with like three towers in it. And she used to talk about the fact that the towers may be the sort of individual areas of excellence where tobacco cessation or cardiovascular may work, and then this kind of low-lying place where they look for what are sort of the commonalities that they can find, whether those are in prevention messages, since obviously working on tobacco and nutrition and physical activity may have positive outcomes for cardiovascular, cancer, and diabetes, asthma, other things. But also on the care setting, and how do you make sure when people are getting in the care setting that they're being looked at comprehensively and that we're, you know, reducing the number of stops clients need to make, cross-training individuals, both clinical providers who should have that training but sometimes get very specialized, and also community health workers and patient navigators so that they have sufficient expertise to provide case management and patient navigation services in a joint way. Sure.
What is the timeline that it took for you guys to move towards that integrated?
So, you know, a lot of folks say we've already been trying to do a lot of this work. It is a long-term process. The CDC pilot projects were launched officially January 1 of this year, of 2009, and go for 3 years. Although we spent the previous 6 months working on an initial work plan to be submitted to the CDC after we had done a preliminary application to be accepted as a pilot site. So we really worked on it all through 2008. And I think now in 2009, we're pulling towards some common activities and really sort of hitting, I'd say, phase two, where people are sort of starting to understand their concept. And it runs officially through 2011, but I don't think we'll be done.
Maybe one more question, any others?
Just mainly a comment. I work for an HIV program, and you know, now the whole idea is HIV is a chronic disease, but mm-hmm. in our community, we're still having difficulty, you know, changing people's perception of HIV as a chronic disease, and having that whole integration of care, which is needed so desperately for that population because of all of the
subsequent chronic diseases that they face because of the disease and medication. So I would love to talk to you more about, you know, some of the steps that we could possibly apply in our community. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And even structurally, we've linked HIV and AIDS more with other infectious diseases, including STDs and tuberculosis and hepatitis, which, you know, has a certain logic. And yet, I think it would be important to see if we can make that broader
towards the chronic disease.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm happy to talk with you.